Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. Aboriginal tourism is a key goal of the Northwest Territories government. The Missing Women Commission inquiry will soon be holding public forums and hopes to move ahead despite controversy. The Health Council of Canada highlights Aboriginal maternal and child health in a newly released report. And a group from Northern Ontario has embarked on a long walk to reach the next national event of the Truth and Reconciliation event in Halifax in October. A priest in Northwestern Ontario has been named an honorary chief. All these stories plus great tunes from Inez coming right up after your news. Here is your national Aboriginal news. Two teenage girls have been arrested in the death of a Sandy Bay First Nation woman. Police say Roberta McIver died in her car and was found decapitated along a road July 10th. The 15 and 17-year-old girls have been charged with manslaughter on the First Nation in Manitoba. Media reports say the girls have been remanded in custody. The chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations has been temporarily suspended from his duties. News Talk 650 reports Guy Lonechild and his staff have been suspended until September 1st, when a vote of non-confidence will be held. Lonechild received notice from current interim chief Morley Watson. The chiefs of the Federation held a hearing earlier this month to determine whether Lonechild should face a vote of non-confidence over a drunk driving conviction. The Quebec government is to acknowledge the impact of the slaughter of sled dogs in Nunavik. According to Nanatsiak News, Quebec government officials, Makavik Corporation and Katavik regional government officials have signed an agreement in which the province will recognize the impact of the slaughter of sled dogs in Nunavik between 1950 and 1960. The agreement comes from a report in 2010 by Jean-Jacques Cruteau, a retired Quebec Superior Court judge. The Missing Women Commission inquiry in BC is set to host forums in nine communities in northern BC. The inquiry has been a point of contention for a few First Nation groups in the downtown east side. Spokesperson for the commission, Chris Frymond, says the biggest challenge so far has been the province's decision not to fund groups and individuals that were granted standing. Frymond says the unfunded groups and individuals have helpful perspectives for the inquiry.
There are 13 groups in all that were granted standing, other than the police forces and the provincial attorney general's office. And of those groups, the government decided to fund legal representation for only one of them, and that was for a lawyer who's representing some of the families of the murdered and missing women. Now, the other groups the commissioner felt were important to the commission, to the commission's work, because they had specific perspectives on these issues, particularly the downtown east side of Vancouver and Aboriginal and Native women's issues.
The commission recently announced a compromise with interest groups to hire extra lawyers. The groups say it's not enough, and SICA's First Nation Chief Jackie Thomas says the commission is not welcome in her community. Despite the growing negativity about the inquiry, Frymond is hopeful the commission will be able to do its work.
We're aware of some of the negative comments that have been made. We believe that the commission has a lot of very important work to do, and as I mentioned earlier, the legal representation for several of the families of murdered and missing women is being paid for by the provincial government, and they certainly, from our understanding, are eager to participate and to have their questions answered and to make their views known. So we certainly believe that the commission can do some very good work and come up with some answers and recommendations to the issues that it's been asked to look at.
The commission has hired two independent lawyers to help ensure the voices of Vancouver's downtown east side community and Aboriginal women are presented at the inquiry. Two other lawyers have agreed to work for the commission pro bono. 230 First Nations have pulled out of the National Panel on Education. Lyle Whitefish, Vice Chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, thinks the federal government will try to impose one-size-fits-all legislation to Aboriginal education. They worry any new legislation won't take into account the diversity of nations and cultures across the country. The National Panel on Education was launched by the Assembly of First Nations and the Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Ministry to look at ways to improve education for First Nations students. The Cohen Commission inquiry has been extended for another year because of important findings. The Cohen Commission is looking into the decline of sockeye in the Fraser River. The Squamish Nation supports that extension. They provided a lot of testimony and documentation to the inquiry. There's a secret Aboriginal burial ground that's not so secret anymore. The Canadian Press reports the province of Saskatchewan set aside a 4-hectare parcel of crown land along the South Saskatchewan River. That's where the historic remains of nearly 200 unidentified Aboriginal people have been laid to rest over the past 14 years. Carlos German, director of Saskatchewan's Heritage Branch, told CP, confidentiality has to be maintained and it's considered a sacred ground to First Nations. And the burial site is unique because it accommodates different nation affiliations. The province set aside the land in 1998 to reinter remains that had nowhere else to go, like bones lying on museum and university shelves. German says it's the only one like it in the country. A priest in northwestern Ontario has been named an honorary chief. Reverend Larry Croker of St. Anne's Church was recognized for his 4 decades of work with Fort William First Nation. Philip Helche is a counselor at Fort William First Nation, and he says Croker has been valuable to the community.
He's provided leadership, he's provided strength, he's provided, you know, service. He's just been a wealth of knowledge for the community, and he's also been a good people for in time of need or in time of some inspiration. You know, he's been a very good person.
Father Croker feels blessed the community wanted to celebrate his 40-year anniversary in the church.
The community, they wanted to celebrate something with my life, and it's good that we have something to celebrate, and certainly I'm grateful, mostly grateful, the experience of being made the honorary chief, and my friends, all my friends that have been with me that journey for so many years, is really a time of blessing.
Croker was named honorary chief in Fort William First Nation on August 6th. The Health Council of Canada is out with a report on Aboriginal and maternal child health. John Abbott is the CEO of the Health Council of Canada. He says the report examines ways to improve and promote services for moms and infants.
The focus of our study was really to look at and how we can give a voice to what is happening across Canada in our Aboriginal communities in improving the design and delivery of programs and services to help young mothers, young infants to grow and mature and survive.
The report is available in full on the Health Council of Canada's website. The Northwest Territories is looking into advancing Aboriginal tourism. The government has recently appointed 7 NWT residents to a new Aboriginal Tourism Champions Advisory Council. Bob McLeod is the Minister of Industry, Tourism and Investment. McLeod says Aboriginal tourism was a key goal identified in the Tourism 2015 strategic plan. McLeod is excited about the future of Aboriginal tourism.
Quite excited about it. We think we have 33 communities in the Northwest Territories, and we think that Aboriginal tourism will help promote each of these communities, help create sustainable employment, and will obviously celebrate Aboriginal culture, increase pride in Aboriginal heritage and youth, and also promote the culture and traditions of Northwest Territories Aboriginal groups.
McLeod adds the government is putting money into the project in addition to several other programs with resources available in the future. The Truth and Reconciliation Walkers are well into their journey. A group of 6 walkers left Cochrane, Ontario, July 29th. They're walking to the Truth and Reconciliation National Event in Halifax, slated for October 26th to the 29th. Patrick Etherington is leading the walk. He says the residential school experience has personally affected him.
It has affected in different aspects of my life in terms of the struggling of personal issues, and also the impacts of alcoholism and drugs, and also the realizations of more communications with family members and my own family, and certain impacts of that loss, and also the loss of other family members, and these things of how they are like locked away kind of thing.
Atherington hopes to bring awareness about residential school experiences to non-Aboriginal people. Four youth are included among the walkers journeying to Halifax. And former Ontario Lieutenant Governor James Bartleman could become the next winner of a coveted writing award. Bartleman's book, As Long as the River Flows, has been submitted by his publisher for the Giller Prize. The book is a fictional novel which follows the story of Martha, a residential school survivor who returned to her community and struggled through recovery and healing. The Giller Prize annually awards $50,000 to the author of the best Canadian novel or short story collection. The winner will be announced November 8th. And that's your National Aboriginal News. Inez, solo singer-songwriter with Bounce from her CD, Sing Soul Girl. The government of the Northwest Territories wants to advance Aboriginal tourism. It recently appointed seven residents to a new Aboriginal Tourism Champions Advisory Council to help with the process. Here's Bob McLeod, Minister of Industry, Tourism and Investment, to explain.
Well, we have been working very hard to develop our tourism industry in the Northwest Territories, and we've developed a tourism 2015 strategic plan for the Northwest Territories, and part of that is to develop a Aboriginal tourism strategy. So in order for us to go forward on that, part of our process is to appoint an Aboriginal Tourism Champion Advisory Council. We're going to hold a forum this fall, and one of the major responsibilities of The council is to help us and guide us in developing a 3 to 5 year Aboriginal tourism strategy for the Northwest Territories.
So what currently is there as far as Aboriginal tourism goes?
We have individual products in different communities, and at the Vancouver Olympic Paralympic Games, we had the Northwest Territories and Yukon and Nunavut. We had Canada's Northern House, which was very successful. We had over 255,000 people go through there, and the whole premise of Northern House was to promote our Aboriginal culture and way of life, and we found there's a lot of demand for people that want to come up and have an Aboriginal experience, mm-hmm. authentic Aboriginal experience. So those people that were at Northern House that have come up found that there wasn't a lot of Aboriginal tourism products available.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think you can see in the plan that Aboriginal tourism can be streamlined into mainstream tourism? I see that it works really well in British Columbia.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we want to learn from them. We've actually had people from British Columbia come up and talk to us about how they went about it. And so now we're working on doing the same kind of thing.
Okay, so I actually think that's everything from me. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
We're quite excited about it. We think we have 33 communities in the Northwest Territories, and we think that Aboriginal tourism will help promote each of these communities, help create sustainable employment, while obviously celebrating Aboriginal culture, increase pride in Aboriginal heritage and youth, and also promote the culture and traditions of Northwest Territories Aboriginal groups.
Okay, so that brings me into another thing. Do you think that there'd perhaps be funding in the future to assist with marketing Aboriginal tourism?
For sure. I mean, we're putting money into this, and we also have different funding programs, and we've identified Aboriginal tourism as a priority, so definitely there'll be resources available.
That was Bob McLeod, Minister of Industry, Tourism and Investment in the Northwest Territories. The Missing Women Commission Inquiry is investigating the Robert Picton case, as well as the Highway of Tears incidents and how women have slipped through the cracks. The inquiry hasn't been without controversy, since many groups with standing have pulled out of the inquiry as the province decided not to fund legal fees. However, the commission is moving ahead and will be holding public forums, and it's also hired a couple of extra lawyers to help go through the evidence. Chris Frymond is the spokesperson for the commission.
Those forums in nine communities in Northern BC will be held between the 12th and the 22nd of September. The exact venues and the communities where they'll be held is still being decided and will be announced shortly. These forums are part of what is called the study commission portion of the inquiry, and the study commission is a more informal part of the commission, where the commissioner invites, in this case, members of communities to come forward and make presentations on issues that are important to them with regard to missing and murdered women.
And you mentioned challenges earlier, and what are some of the challenges for the commission at this time?
Well, the biggest challenge so far has been the provincial government's decision not to fund the groups and individuals that were granted standing by the commissioner, before the commission. There are 13 groups in all that were granted standing, other than the police forces and the provincial attorney general's office. And of those groups, the government decided to fund legal representation for only one of them, and that was for a lawyer who's representing some of the families of the murdered and missing women. Now, the other groups the commissioner felt were important to the commission, to the commission's work, because they had specific perspectives on these issues, particularly the downtown east side of Vancouver and Aboriginal and Native women's issues. And by not having funding, a number of these groups have decided that they will not be able to participate in the inquiry, which is a big disappointment to the Commission.
Now, do you think you'll be able to get their views at any other time or and try and get their participation in some way?
Well, there is an alternative proposal. An alternative approach is underway right now, and that is for the Commission itself to contract up to four lawyers to represent the broad perspectives of, on the one hand, the downtown East Side communities, and on the other hand, the perspective of Native and Aboriginal women. These lawyers will be under contract to Commission, but they would work at arm's length, and they wouldn't represent any specific client, but they would, we hope, represent the broad perspectives of those two different communities. By going out and gathering information to either present to the Commission or to use in cross-examination of some of the witnesses that will be called.
Mm. Do you think that that some of the negative media will have impeded the Commission's work, like we just talked about some of the Aboriginal groups pulling out, and also one of the chiefs speaking out that the Commission is not welcome in her community?
Yes, we're aware of some of the negative comments that have been made. We believe that the Commission has a lot of very important work to do, and as I mentioned earlier, the legal representation for several of the families of murdered and missing women is being paid for by the provincial government, and they certainly, from our understanding, are eager to participate and to have their questions answered and to make their views known. So we certainly believe that the Commission can do some very good work and come up with some answers and recommendations to the issues that it's been asked to look at.
And now, moving back to the next month's forums, and you said that the communities will be announced at a later date, but so are there any First Nation communities going to be included in the forum hearings?
Not clear at this stage. The Commission was hoping to include some First Nations communities, but it will obviously depend on whether or not it's seen to be welcome, because it is necessary to work in cooperation with whatever communities the Commission decides to visit, and if they're not welcome, obviously the hearings will be held in other venues. The Commission is very eager. The Commission is very eager to hear from First Nations communities, and particularly from the families of people who have been impacted by murdered and missing women in not only the downtown Vancouver area, but in other parts of the province as well. And that is part of the mandate, to look at the way inquiries are held into cases of murdered and missing women throughout the province.
And so after the forums, what are the next steps?
Well, after the forums, the Commission returns to Vancouver, and on October the 11th begins the other portion of the inquiry, which is known as a hearing commission, and that is the more formal portion. That is where it's more adversarial. Typically, participants do have their own lawyers. There is cross-examination, and it's more like a traditional courtroom setting where there is cross-examination, as I say, and questioning.
Okay, and when will the Commission release a report with recommendations on all of the hearings and forums?
When the Commission was formed, it was asked by the government to report by the end of the year, but it's quite clear at this stage that that's not going to be possible. The preparatory work has taken much longer than it expected, so it's likely that the Commissioner will ask for an extension to probably sometime next year, and hopefully that's when the reports will be issued.
That was Chris Frymond, spokesperson for the Missing Women Commission Inquiry in BC. Here's another tune from Inez. She was also named a National Aboriginal Role Model in 2008. Here's Move Slow.
Time.
Health Council of Canada has recently released a report and commentary on Aboriginal maternal and child health. John Abbott is the CEO of the Health Council of Canada, and he'll tell us about that report.
The focus of our study was really to look at and how we can give a voice to what is happening across Canada in our Aboriginal communities in improving the design and delivery of programs and services to help young mothers, young infants to grow and mature and survive when we know there are so many compelling health and social issues facing our Aboriginal communities. So the report is based on the consultations we did across Canada this past winter, where we worked with, spoke with, and consulted with a wide variety of frontline workers, whether it's social workers, nurse practitioners, and community health workers working in the field of maternal and child health.
And you mentioned that the report covers what's been happening across the country. So what has been happening with respect to those issues?
Well, what we have seen and heard through the consultations and workshops are the fact that there are many, many significant promising practices that are in place today that cut across departmental and organization lines, that are focused on helping young mothers with parenting skills, with nutrition guidelines, those kinds of things to help them in their pregnancy and certainly when they deliver their child. We also know that there are some challenges in making sure that these programs and services that are working, whether it's the Aboriginal Head Start program, some parental parenting programs that are either funded or delivered through the federal government across the north and elsewhere. We want to make sure that those stories were getting out to as broad an audience as possible, and support provides that information as well.
And also, when I was reading in the press release, what's suggested in there that there are health inequalities, and what are the health inequalities?
Well, unfortunately, in Canada, you know, we know that the difference in health status and health outcomes differ quite markedly between our Aboriginal peoples and the rest of Canadians. For example, we know that Aboriginal children are more likely to die in the first year of life than elsewhere across the country, and Aboriginal people are less likely to graduate from high school because of the not having the advantage in an early childhood because of the conditions that they're living in. So there's many programs and services now been designed to sort of counteract and to improve that situation. So in fact, those disparities are reduced over time. It will take concerted effort by certainly the frontline workers and the organizations they work with, but also that there is sustained funding to support them for the long term, because there's no quick fix to the challenges here. It's going to take a lot of effort over a long period of time to rewrite this situation in Canada.
And so what are some of the programs that are working?
Well, the report has a compendium which outlines quite a number of programs and services right across this country, whether in the East Coast, the Northern Canada, the Prairies, and the West Coast. Some of the examples are the Aboriginal Head Start program, which helps young mothers. We also have the maternal and child health program funded by Ottawa, and we have the Aboriginal Head Start program, which is seen as being very, very, very effective. The challenge is, are those services and programs available in all our communities where they're needed? And the answer is no, and we need to ensure that those best and promising practices around maternal and child health are expanded. We need to obviously support midwifery programs in the north so that we can have more of our Aboriginal children born at home. Right now in Canada, In northern Canada, we have many of our children, mothers, young mothers, have to fly south to deliver their babies, and they have to leave home. People know that in the north, and we'd like to see that repatriated in as many communities as possible. So we're seeing many of the programs and services and initiatives are striving to achieve that.
That was John Abbott, CEO of the Health Council of Canada. It's going to be a long walk for a group of six people. The group began their walk from Cochrane in North Ontario on July 29th. They're walking to Halifax to make it to the Truth and Reconciliation of Canada national event slated for late October. Patrick Etherington is leading the walk, and he hopes to bring awareness to what residential school survivors have faced and are still facing.
We've done it on the and support and to create awareness about the impact of residential school, and to do it by walking, that we were walking with the staff and to help the people recognize the impacts in regards to the survivors and their families and their grandchildren and in the communities. And we are walking with young youth that are starting to recognize the importance of creating awareness and educating more in terms of the impacts of residential school and how that impact has made us struggling in certain issues and how this is being implemented in regards to what the agreement about to help the residential school survivors and to create more awareness with the Native communities and to create education with the non-Native communities as we keep on.
And Patrick, so how has the residential school experience impacted your life?
It has affected in different aspects of my life in terms of the struggling of personal issues and also the impacts of alcoholism and drugs, and also the realizations of more communications with family members and my own family, and certain impacts of that loss, and also the loss of other family members, and these things of how they are like locked away kind of thing. And so these, when we're walking, we are able to talk about it and share it, and the youth, and how they begin to look at the ways of recognizing where some of these come from and the impacts of these kind of issues.
And so how many youth are with you, and what have your conversations been like?
We have four youth that are with us, and we have one woman, my partner, that walks with us, and the conversations have been based on the impact of residential school, and at the same time, we are recognizing the importance of what it is that we are starting to have a representation within it regarding to the ceremonial and the traditional and the spiritual aspect of what we represent. We have an eco staff in front of us, and we're starting to get offerings of support, and also asking people for help in how we take care of that. Then we keep walking because of the support of and how these young people are starting to understand and what they're doing and how they're taking that part and helping it and protecting it and supporting it and thinking about themselves at the same time, what it is that they're doing.
Okay.
And those kind of conversations have become in from them.
So I know you just started your walk July 29th, and what kind of support or other comments from community members where you've stopped?
There has been support in regards to giving us encouragement, giving us like for water to drink and food to eat, and also at the same time to have an opportunity to discuss what it is that we're doing and how, and also organizations that are working in the helping field in how they are been in support of what we're doing and what that encouragement means and how the growth of disinformation is beginning to relate to what it is that we're doing and how the camaraderie and the effect that happens on even in some non-native communities where they have asked description of what has happened in the impact of resident schools. These and how the media have begin to approach us and how they're beginning to advocate in their this that they do from the media, and this has become a growing process.
And has there been any surprises for you, Patrick?
The most surprising realization is how time is with you on your walk and that personal time that's there with yourself and also with your group. And when you meet people who stop or who give us encouragement and how these encouragements really fulfill that aspect it's almost like a feeding, and it really touches us in a deep place. It's been that way in the growing way we meet when we come to communities and spend time with people and how we interact and share and how people have given us that that encouragement part and how it has really given us a touch of feeling of fulfillment.
That was Patrick Etherington. He's leading a walk to Halifax for the next Truth and Reconciliation of Canada national event in late October. Now here's one last tune from Inez. Her album Sing Soul Girl was nominated for a Juno last year. So here's another cut from that CD, and this one is Sing Soul Girl.
So I sing soul girl, I sing soul girl. There have been times for my family when things got rough, and my mama and my daddy just had enough. Water in the well has just run dry. I can't cry. Tears turned to rain and the rain did pour, and the clouds turned to sun and it was day once more. Power from the light, people rose again. Music from the skyland and earth begins. I sing soul girl, I sing soul, I sing soul girl. Sing soul girl, sing soul girl.
A priest in Northwestern Ontario has been named an honorary chief in Fort William First Nation in recognition of his 40 years of work in and around First Nations in the area. First, Philip Pelche, a counselor at Fort William, tells us why Reverend Larry Croker was so honored.
Larry Croker, he's been working in the community in Northwestern Ontario with First Nation these 40 years. Been back and forth to Fort William First Nation a few times. He's provided leadership, he's provided strength, he's provided, you know, service. He's just been a wealth of knowledge for the community, and he's also been a good people in time of need or in time of some inspiration. You know, he's been a very good person.
Wow, and this is certainly a different story than one, I guess, that we've been used to hearing about.
Oh, yeah, no. Priests haven't always gotten a good rap in the communities. I mean, there's still people in our community that don't believe in the Catholic system anymore for whatever reason, you know, mostly because of residential school. But he has been a positive effect in our community and good inspirational too. I think because he gets the OT, he stands beside the hunter, he stands beside the fisherman, he gets actively involved. And I think through involvement, that's how people see him, not just as a priest, but as somebody who's involved in the community.
And so who decided to name him an honorary chief?
I think that it just came through the community, you know, that people, a lot of people that attend the church. I think Gene Bannon, Justice of the Peace, had a big role to play. But yeah, it was something felt throughout our own Fort William First Nation community and the city of Thunder Bay, where he runs the Kateri Center in Thunder Bay.
Okay, and the other thing I want to know is, what does honorary chief actually mean? And does that title come with any other roles and responsibilities?
Honorary chief is, you know, you must defend the Ojibwe way of life, the culture, must stand behind it. And to be an honorary chief, it recognizes that he sees the importance of First Nation culture. You know, he tried to preserve our way of life and also our culture, both in the Catholic Church, you know, in our ceremonies. He does honor them. So, overall, he's a good guy, really good guy for that.
That was Philip Pelche, Fort William First Nation Counselor. Now here's Reverend Larry Croker on his work over the past 40 years, plus how he felt being named an honorary chief.
This past Saturday, on the mountain, Mount McKay, there was the conferring of honorary chief on myself. I was ordained in 1971, and so for 40 years then, I've been working as pastor in many of the Native communities in the area, but especially here at St. Anne's. And as the chief said, there's been many things in those 40 years, a lot of changes that I've been part of, and some difficult and some very wonderful. One of the themes, of course, is when back 40 years ago, the reserves were very much wards of the state and the very poor self-image, but now the theme of First Nation, that somehow they have something to be proud of. So there's been a lot of movement just as to, you know, the Native people and appreciation and enjoy it, who they are. So that's one thing going through that movement with them. There's also been a lot of changes in the church. When I began in 1971, the priest was pretty much in charge of the distribution of the sacraments and the voice of the church, but that has all changed. When I began, we looked and, you know, looking at the faith of the community, wondering, you know, why is it that the priest is the one who is in charge of the faith community? Why not some of the Native people themselves? They certainly have the gift. And so the change then from the priest looking at the development of the Native diaconate program, where the Native people then, as deacons, ordained deacons then, could administer the sacraments like marriage and do funerals and do baptisms and preach. And also the other people in the community, also in the church, there's also the development of the ministry. So at one time only a priest would give communion. Now different people from the community every Sunday, they come up and they're on the altar and they help distribute community. They take communion to the sick in the hospitals and the shut-ins. They also do the readings in the church and so on. So that change again where, you know, all of the people, they all have a gift. Something to share for the life of the faith community. So that's also been a big change. The priest is just one among many as far as sharing the faith and and talking about Christ to others. Those are two things. Another thing, of course, has been that I've been part of is the numbers of Native people that come to the city. When I first came to Thunder Bay back then, there was maybe 2,000 people in the city. Now they say there's around 20,000, and the year 2020, they say in Thunder Bay, there's probably half the city may be Native. And so looking at that, the development of that, and so the establishing of a Native church, a Native Catholic church in the city, it's kind of a church that's open to all Native peoples coming in and visiting. So the Kichitwa Kadri Church in the city of Thunder Bay, and again, it's run by a Native woman, a Native person. She's in charge of it. I go there as priest. And so it's a place then where Native people come into the city who feel culture shock. So a place where they can go and they can feel comfortable. The church, it looks very much like a Native church. It's got Native art in it. It's got different Native designs. And of course, the Native people. And so it's a place where people coming to the city, especially for the first time or so, a place where they can feel comfortable with other Native people and also continue the faith that they shared in the communities is also present for them in the city. So that would be another part, part of my life that I've shared with the people. I guess one of my own things too is, my own prayer life, and as a Jesuit then, based on the spiritual exercise of St. Ignatius, of also then being with the people and helping them in how to pray, especially reading and reflecting, praying on the scriptures, and finding really their own ground for their spiritual journey. So we do that every year now. We have in both St. Anne's Church here and at the Catholic Church in the city, we have a formation in prayer and going through different exercises for prayer, people to really deepen their prayer life and their encounter with Christ. Another part, of course, has been the theme of the pain and the abuse that has come and been both within the church and all around, and being with the people in that part of the journey, first almost disbelief that it could happen within the church, and then what to do about as far as reconciliation and the healing process. So those are some of the different areas, being part of over the last 40 years, and the chief kind of, Peter Collins, he kind of acknowledged that, the journey hasn't always been that easy, but it's been a place, where I've grown with the people, and we've met these different challenges, and we've all grown because of it. The people then I become good friends with, and they really opened up my life, they really challenged and opened up my faith life, too. So it's that's just kind of a bit of an overview, 40 years, and so we celebrate life, so the community, they wanted to celebrate something with my life, and it's good that we have something to celebrate, and certainly I'm grateful, mostly grateful, the experience of being made the honorary chief, and all my friends that have been with in that journey for so many years. It's really a time of blessing.
Were you surprised when you knew you were going to be honored as an honorary chief?
Yeah, because it wasn't my doing. It was one of the Native people kind of suggested it at a Native Corps committee when we were looking at how to celebrate my 40th anniversary, but also the 400 years of when the first Jesuits first came to Canada in 1611. The first two Jesuits landed in Port Royal, and Father Biard and Father Massey, and celebrating that, and then also my. So anyhow, that's out of that. Then somebody kind of said, "Well, one way to celebrate is the honorary chief thing," and then it had to be brought to the chief and council, and they approved it, and it turned out to be a wonderful experience.
That was Reverend Larry Croker. You've been listening to Bomb Siddha with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bomb Siddha is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddha means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsedda.com. That's BAMOSEDA. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddha.